I don't like, what else don't I like?
Squash.
My plate was full of mashed potatoes. That's about the only thing. Stuffing if it doesn't have onions. And of course, unfortunately, where I eat Thanksgiving, we have turkey there, and sometimes the stuffing comes from out of the turkey, and I don't want to eat that. But I do like the mashed potatoes, and I do like the pie. My wife made some wonderful pumpkin pie that was just absolutely amazing. Squash? I don't like squash. No, I don't like squash. Squash? Oh, pumpkin is a squash? Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, there's different types of squashes that are all right. But I was thrilled to discover that my aunt, who is this amazing cook, she has like 1,000 recipes in her computer and she just loves cooking, she admitted that she doesn't like Thanksgiving food either. I said, I'm not the only one. But you know, food is not the reason we really come together, is it? When we got together this week, our whole time together as a family revolved around food. We came on Wednesday, we had a big meal Wednesday evening, we had a big meal Thursday morning, we had a big meal, of course, for the Thanksgiving portion. That's not really why we give thanks, though, is it? I want you to open your Bibles to 1 John chapter 4. I hope that you and I both gave thanks to the Lord for this reality that we are going to read this morning. It's a very simple thought. And yet it's profound and deep at the same time. 1 John chapter 4, we're going to jump right in this morning. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8. John says the same thing twice. The last three verses of this word, this verse he repeats a few verses later. But 1 John chapter 4 verse 8, we read these words, "He who does not love does not know God, for..." And here comes these three words, a very simple thought. We've read them before many, many times. The church that I grew up in Massachusetts, on the top of the front there is these three words that says, God is what? Love. God is love. Like I said, we've heard it many times before. We've read it many times before. We take it for granted. And yet this Thanksgiving season, this should be the thing that we are most thankful for. God is love. There's only one other place in the Bible that I've come across where it describes God as a noun as well. In the book of Psalms, a couple of times it says that God is judge, which is a noun. But this is the only other place where it describes God in terms of a noun. And it's kind of weird to our thinking. It'd be like saying, you know, Tyler is fire, or Bob is snow. This is, God is love. It's a noun. It's not an adjective. It doesn't say God is loving. You know, you and I, if we are blessed, can participate in love at times. We can partake of love at times, but we cannot be described as love. It is not who we are. It is not our essence. It is not our character. Of course, God invites us to participate in it, does He not? He invites us to partake of that from Him. But this is who God is. This is His essence. This is His very being. God is love. The word, of course, in the Greek is the word what? Agape. Now we're going to unpack that a little bit this morning, this afternoon. What does it mean that God is agape love? As you maybe are well aware, in the Biblical Greek, there were four words for love that could be used by any biblical author. We in English have one word for love that encapsulates a lot of different things, don't we? One of my friends who's written a book put it this way: we use one word for love that is holy, and the same word for love that is holy Hollywood. We're very limited in our meaning of the word love because we use it for many different contexts. We may say to our wife or our husband or our child, I love you. And then 10 minutes later, we may say, I love pumpkin pie. See, we're very limited. We have one word to describe many different things, many different emotions or affections. Like I said, though, in the Greek, they had four different words. We won't look at two of them. But the first is the word agape that we've discovered is in this passage itself. But the other word for love that was used quite often in those days is the word eros. You've heard the term eros before, I'm sure. Just this week when we were down on Cape Cod with my family, we looked at some slides from my aunt and uncle who had just returned from Italy and Greece and Turkey. They had been there for 10 or 14 days. And one of the pictures that they had was a picture of a plaque from Turkey. And on that plaque it said, Eros is the mightiest of all gods. In the Greek and Roman mindset, this Eros was named after this Greek god Eros, which was the god of love. The Roman equivalent was the god Cupid. I'm sure you've heard of Cupid before, that pink little character who has a bow and arrows. And what does he do? Cupid pulls back the arrow, and it shoots somebody, and as soon as you are hit with that arrow, you do what? You fall in love. You fall head over heels for whoever Cupid wants you to. Unfortunately, what happens? Cupid takes that arrow out, and all of a sudden those feelings of love have disappeared mysteriously until you are struck with love for the next person that Cupid wants you to fall in love with. It's interesting because I've read that researchers have discovered, this is relevant especially to young people, that in love feeling that you get initially when you are attracted to somebody, at the most it lasts for 2 years. That's the longest it lasts. That little warm feeling of excitement, that little twitter that you get in your heart, it lasts at the most for 2 years. And then it dies out. And what happens so often is that when it dies out, young people especially don't know how to deal with it. They say, well, that feeling went away, so I'm going to move on to the next person whom Cupid mysteriously casts his spell on you to be in love with. That's the problem with this Eros experience. Just as quickly as you can fall in love, you can fall out of love. And it's interesting because nowhere in the Bible do the biblical authors use the word eros. It was as far from what their understanding of love was that you could get. And so they dared not use that term eros to describe either what the Christian was to involve him or herself in or what God was all about. Because, quite simply, if I were to use one word to equate eros with, it would be selfish. That's what eros is. Eros is self-centered love. That's why when a man walks down the street and he sees a young lady across the way from him and he starts thinking about her in some way that isn't appropriate, he is acting out of eros love because he is not thinking of her needs, he is thinking of his own gratification. Same thing when two young girls are fighting over the last cookie on the plate. They are acting from self-centered eros love. And so the Bible does not go anywhere near eros. I've heard some people, some very well-meaning Christians, say, you know what? Every marriage needs a little bit of eros to spice things up. Every marriage needs a little of that to make the romance fizzle. And some people have gone to the Song of Solomon, my favorite book, to prove that. They say, you know, the Song of Solomon is a very erotic book. I've seen commentaries titled that very thing, The Erotic Song. But wouldn't you know it, when the Greek translators came along and translated the book Song of Solomon from Hebrew to Greek, they never once used the word eros. When they were describing the love between the man and the woman in the Song of Solomon, they always translated the Hebrew word as agape. Because the Christian, the follower of God, does not need to participate in eros because we naturally have a bent towards eros. That's why John comes along and he says, God is agape. God is love. Whereas eros is self-seeking and self-serving. We call that egocentricity. Agape is other-centered or alterocentric. In fact, if you look just the chapter before, John gives us a definition of this agape love quite beautifully in 1 John 3:16. It's a twin passage of John 3:16. Notice what he says in 1 John 3:16. By this we know what? We know agape. If you want to know what agape love is, if you want to understand what this is all about, because he laid down his life for us. Jesus gave of himself for us. He poured out himself for us. He didn't try to hoard for himself. He gave of himself. He laid down his life. He went to the cross for us. There was a lady by the name of Hannah Moore who lived in the 17th and 18th century. She was a very good friend of William Wilberforce's. William Wilberforce, as probably many of us know, was the key figure, the central figure in Britain in the abolition of slavery. And I'm reading a book on his life right now, and I came across this lady, Hannah Moore, who was a contemporary of his, a very good friend of his. She was known as the Queen of the Methodists. And she was a very prolific author, so prolific, in fact, that she actually outsold Jane Austen in her day. And she wrote on things from theology to politics to everyday, you know, etiquette. But one of the very profound statements she wrote, I wish you would write this down. I was hoping to make a study guide today, but I ran out of time. But I want you to write down what she has written about love. Very, very profound. One of the most profound insights into the subject that I have come across. So take out your pencil or pen and write it down. Notice what Hannah Moore says. She writes, love never reasons, but profusely gives. Let me repeat that. We're going to go on for a little more of what she says on it. But get that right from the beginning. Love never reasons, but profusely gives. Notice what she says. It gives like a thoughtless prodigal its all and then trembles lest it has done too little. Let me repeat that again. Love never reasons, but profusely gives. It gives like a thoughtless prodigal and then trembles lest it has done too little. I read that, I said, wow, there is the definition of agape love. It gives and gives and gives and gives like a thoughtless prodigal. And then stays up all night worrying that it has not given enough. Can you see God right there, right now? The book of Isaiah tells us that God never slumbers or sleeps. Maybe he's up trying to figure out if he has given enough. But can you see God right there? Giving and giving and giving and giving and giving. And then worrying that he has not given enough. God is agape love. That's why Paul can write in the book of Romans that God demonstrates his own love for us and that while we were still sinners. In fact, he says just a few verses later, while we were enemies, Christ died for us. See, God is the ultimate other-centered being. He is the ultimate alterocentric being. He gives and gives and gives. He's not trying to take and take and take. And we have it all backwards. We have created God in our image as if he was trying to get something out of us. As if he was trying to hoard for himself. But God gives and gives and gives and gives. And then worries lest he is not given enough. Very simple concept. One that we, for some reason, have a hard time getting into our minds. God is agape love. It's no mystery that I've come to realize and appreciate this all the more since I've been a parent. Many times, Camille especially has said, I don't understand how people can be mean or not love little children. As sinful as we are and as self-centered as we are, God has blessed us and given us the gracious gift of almost naturally being affectionate towards the children that He blesses us with. Now, occasionally there is somebody who, for some reason, does not love their children. That seems to be backwards from what God has blessed us with. But you look at that small little child and you understand all the more God's love. He created us. He brought us into this world, and His heart is naturally drawn to us, is naturally gracious and loving and other-centered towards us. And He says, I am going to keep on loving you. That's what my essence is. That is my divine motive. That is why I do what I do. Everything I do is couched in this reality that I am love. You know, some people have thought, and I have bought into it at times before, that God doesn't see anything valuable in us. Have you ever heard this idea before? He loves us simply because He's love, and there's nothing of value in us to Him. I love what one of my favorite authors, Carsten Johnson, has written. Listen to what he says about this idea. Kind of a long quotation, but I hope you'll keep up with it. He says, the fact that man is God's own creature is reason enough for Him to love that man. As I said, the fact that Camden is my son, that's reason enough for me to love him. And I'll never stop loving him. In fact, it is not only an intelligent reason, it is an absolutely inevitable reason. As long as creation is a fact... Now, we're going to return to this in January, the topic of creation. Some people would like to make it a non-fact. But he says, as long as creation is a fact, and then he says, and I do not see who could manage to change it into a non-fact, for even God cannot reverse history or make done things undone, you are the Creator's creature. Did you catch that? He says, as long as creation is a fact, as long as the reality is that God has created us, you are the Creator's creature. And there's nothing that can change that. Not even God can reverse that. Not even God can change history. So for that simple fact that you are His creature, you yourself, now listen to this, you yourself, even with the most obstinate efforts of your willpower, you can try and try and try, you yourself cannot move one single inch from the unshakable fact that He is your maker, the generator of your life, the constant upholder of your existence. You and I can try and try and try, and some of us do, to get farther and farther and farther away from the fact that He is our Creator, He is our Maker, but that cannot change it because He has created us. No one can change that reality. And that lends itself to the beautiful truth that God will never stop loving us. He will never stop acting towards us from the motivation of love. So how... You know, when we wake up in the morning, we look down, we pinch our own skin, we say, yep, I'm alive. God has created me. Nothing can change that fact. Therefore, nothing will ever change the fact that God is love and He works towards me from the motivation of love. It's a mystery how anyone could ever doubt that. And yet many people sadly do. G.K. Chesterton shared this insight that I thought was very wonderful. He said, love is not blind. That is the last thing it is. Love is bound. I like that. Love isn't blind, it's bound. And so long as Carsten Johnson, as he says, God has created us and we can't change that fact, so long as that is a reality, and it always will be a reality, God's heart is bound to us. What did we learn a few weeks ago? That He has made an everlasting covenant with all of us. He has made an everlasting covenant of peace, and to love us and to provide for us. How can we not be thankful for that this Thanksgiving? Some of us have probably heard this so many times, and we say, okay, that's nice. I've heard that since I was a little child. I've heard it when I was a teenager. I heard it when I was in college. I've heard it over and over and over and over and over again. And yet it still hasn't sunk in. Maybe some of us have been raised in the church and we have never really been alerted to that reality. But God wants us to know that He is love. His motivation is love. Maybe some of us who've heard that our whole lives, the problem is that we don't feel the need for that love. We haven't been broken. We haven't come to the place where our lives are shattered, and the only thing that's left is God and His love. I don't know what it's going to take, but for the simple fact that God loves you, maybe He'll provide that opportunity for you to be at the depths of despair, to be the lowest of lows. And that would be the merciful thing that He could do for us if we're in that place. What's it going to take for us to understand and enjoy that reality? I think I told a story or two before about a gentleman by the name of Greg Mortensen. He is the subject of the book Three Cups of Tea. Some of you have maybe read that book. New York Times bestseller, and when I picked it up, it was one of those books I couldn't put down. The story begins with him trying to summit K2, the second tallest mountain in the world, perhaps the hardest mountain in the world to climb, even more than Mount Everest. And on his way up during his expedition, they ran into a gentleman who needed their help. And that sidetracked their goal of summiting K2. And so they had to turn around and went back to the bottom of the mountain. But on their way back down, they got separated, and Greg Mortensen got lost. He took one wrong turn, and he found himself in a remote Pakistani village that had never been intruded by outsiders. He was the first outsider to come across this village, especially the first American, and so you can imagine these villagers seeing him for the first time. They were very curious, to say the least. And of course, he was probably a little nervous, having come across these Pakistani villagers, not knowing what they would do to him. But they brought him to the chief of their village, and wouldn't you know that they mended him back to health. He was there for 2 or 3 days, a week maybe. They nursed him back to health, and they pointed him in the right direction to go back to civilization and find his way home. But before he left, for some reason, he made this village a promise that would change his life forever. He said, "I will return one day, and I will build you a school." So they were thrilled to hear this, of course. So he went back to his found civilization, got on a plane, returned to America, tried to resume life as he knew it before, but there was just something in the back of his conscience that said, "You promised this village a school." Well, he was a nurse, didn't have very much money, and he didn't know how he was going to support this endeavor. But one of the things he decided to do was write letters to well-known celebrities and politicians. And over the course of a few months, he wrote 580 letters to various politicians and celebrities, movie stars, people like Oprah and senators and governors. And out of 580 letters, he received one response that had given $100. It was from Tom Brokaw. Bless his heart. They had gone to the same college, not at the same time, but he felt compelled to contribute to a fellow Montanan, if that's what they're called. And so he only had $100. Well, that wasn't going to get him very far. So what he decided to do was move out of his apartment and stay in the back of his car, sleep nights in the back seat of his car. And even then, he had overwhelming feelings of guilt that he wasn't doing enough to raise money for this village. Well, fortunately for him, he ran across this gentleman who was from Switzerland, who is an inventor who lived in the Silicon Valley. The man was a very ornery and miserable man, but for some reason, when Greg Mortensen shared what his mission was, the man bought into it. And he was a multi-billionaire, and he said, "I'm going to fund your project." And once you know it, a year or two after he had been in that same village, Greg Mortensen returned and built that village a school. That wasn't the end of his experience, though. In fact, it just increased. Because this Swiss inventor said, "I want to do more of that for that area of the world." And so, since that time, about 15 years ago, Greg Mortensen has now built something like 60 schools for villages in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Some of the experiences he's had, though, are just unbelievable. While traveling in Pakistan, in the northwest province of Waziristan, which is one of the most war-torn regions in the world, he was taken hostage for, I think, 10 days. This is the same place in Pakistan where many people believe Osama bin Laden is. He's had two fatwas issued against him, which is a declaration from Muslim clerics that this man needs to be killed. He survived that. He's actually sat down and had tea with members of the Taliban. But perhaps, in my mind, the thing that is most troubling is that he regularly receives hate mail from fellow Americans who are upset that he is helping Muslims. The irony, of course, is that he is providing them a better education than they might receive otherwise, because what happens is these young people are scooped up by these Muslim fundamentalists and they're given this extremist education and trained to hate Americans and all others who get in their way. So he's providing a wonderful alternative to their potential education. But here is a man whose heart has been bound to these people. The same people who most of us, if we were to see them, our hearts might be stirred for a few minutes, but then we'd go back to eating our dinner. But his heart has been so overwhelmed with love for these people who don't have much else. And he says, "I'm going to give and give and give and give and give and give and never stop giving." His actions, of course, are but a faint reflection of that God who is agape love. That God who gives and 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 gives. And then trembles, wondering whether he's given enough. Are you thankful for that this Thanksgiving season? I hope that we all are. We all take time to appreciate that reality, that God is love.